started my first business when I was 10 years old. So I think I always had it in me. But, you know, Miami was the type of place where I think it was a real incubator for just that entrepreneurial spirit. Now I know it's a big part of the curriculum, which I think is fantastic.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Beyond High Street. Before we do a little introduction for our next guest, Brian Murphy, a little house cleaning, shout out and thank you to listener Sharif Owusu, who sent me a note this past week after listening to the Tom Fox pod. Tom talked about a favorite professor but could not remember his name, and Sharif responded back, and his name is Dr. Phil Russo, and I guess he's retiring from Miami this coming spring. So thank you, Dr. Russo, for what you do for the students, and I've passed the message along to Tom. For the pod this week, we're talking to Brian Murphy. He's the president and founder of Tomorrow Sleep, a wholly owned subsidiary of Serta Simmons Bedding. Brian actually will be back on campus May 10, judging a Shark Tank-style competition for senior farmer school business students. So look for Brian when he's back on campus in a few weeks. Talk about being ahead of the curve. Brian Murphy, check this out. Creating, building, and selling businesses in tech, web, and venture. Not in 2018, but in the mid-1990s. That is forward thinking, way ahead of the curve, and he's still doing it today. On the pod, he talks about his entrepreneurial spirit starting at the age of 10. That's right, 10. Making custom pies for the neighborhood. When he finished Oxford, he saw a marketplace opportunity in making websites mid-1990s or early 1990s. And as they say, the rest is history. That conversation led to building those sites for many businesses in Detroit and helping him sell his first business to some ventures. And you will hear a funny conversation about that, just going in there for the first time and trying to figure it out. Actually, great to hear. Ultimately sold that business to eBay when he saw there was a marketplace gap in selling some businesses online. And now, as I said earlier, he's the president of Tomorrow Sleep, subsidiary of Serta Simmons. Really fun conversation with Brian. Here we go.
So I'm really excited to head back to Miami this spring, where I've been invited to be a judge in the business idea pitch competition. So that'll be a great opportunity to get back and get back on campus while everything's in full swing and interact with the students that have spent the semester putting together their business plans.
So what do you think? Is that Shark Tank college style? And you've got a couple other alumni in there with you, and kids from the entrepreneur classes or maybe all across Miami get to share business. Is it like class projects or things they're doing on their side that you get to judge? Do you even know that yet?
Yeah. So this is the Farmer School of Business, and these are students who have worked to put together a business plan over the course of this semester. These are seniors, and it's part of the New Venture Creation Capstone course. So a big part of the Institute for Entrepreneurship.
That's awesome.
And I think that's. Yeah, as I said, we've got, they're going to be pitching startup ideas to investors, angels, VC, PE investors, founders of other companies, CEOs, et cetera. So it's going to be, I think, a really great forum for the students to get feedback on their business plans.
I think that's great. I always ask people doing these pods what class they remember from school. And for me, which I never really talk about, was this Entrepreneurship 467, probably the only one I can even remember the number, with John Altman. And just, I would say almost John or Dr. Altman was before his time in thinking entrepreneurship classes 25 years ago. Sadly, I think it was that long ago. But it's great all these guys have the opportunity to do that and then get to present it to you and other CEOs or guys, as you said, in venture capital or private equity.
Yeah, it's funny because I really do think that my experience, you know, I've been an entrepreneur since my early 20s, and I do think that Miami really was a big part of that. I always joke. I started my first business when I was 10 years old. So I think I always had it in me, but you know, Miami was the type of place where, I think it was a real incubator for just that entrepreneurial spirit. And now I know it's a big part of the curriculum, which I think is fantastic.
I mean, you know, I can't let that one go. What was the business when you were 10? Cutting lawns or?
No, even better than that. It was a pie baking business. We lived in a neighborhood that had been formerly an apple and cherry orchard. And so I was this kid that would go around, knock on the door, ask to pick the fruit from the backyard. And I had about 100% close rate on pie sales.
I love it.
No one's going to turn down a 10-year-old kid and bake pies from the fruit from your own trees.
Oh, I think that's great. That's like one of the earlier pods was with John Miller, who, there you go, another delt from Miami, a little older than both you and I, but he had a almost like a Kadima almost franchise for the college campus that he was doing from the high school when he showed up at Miami. So I love the early stories of how people started and doing that stuff.
Yeah, it's funny.
So you go, it's interesting, if you go straight off of a LinkedIn type of profile for you, the three words to me kind of stick out 10, 15, 20 years before everybody else talking about it, from tech, web, and venture. All three of those seem to come through, and obviously want to hear a little bit about Wrenchhead and Autotech and all these places you started, but we're still in 2018. Every day people are talking tech, web, and venture. But it seemed, as you're talking about being an entrepreneur in your early 20s, a lot of that stuff you were already thinking or doing or founding companies, gosh, you know, 25 years ago.
I know. I can't believe it's been that long. But I was really, really fortunate, I feel like, to graduate at the time that I did, because very shortly there, I graduated in 90. And within a few years after that, you know, the internet was just starting to emerge. You know, it was really nothing yet. We were talking about Gopher, you know, from University of Minnesota. You were talking about Mosaic, you know, even before Netscape. And back in 95, I went back to school and I took classes in C++ and Unix, and, you know, would stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to hack into the university mainframe. Not even with a business idea necessarily in mind, but just because I loved it. It was so fascinating to me that, you know, this notion of the internet. And then in 98, clearly began to see, actually early in 97, 98, clearly saw the opportunity and put together a band of merry men. And I happened to be fortunate. I had a lot of friends that were in the advertising business there in Detroit, you know, that worked for Ross Roy and BBDO and Omnicom. And all of their clients needed this thing called a website at the time. And I raised my hand and said, yeah, I can make those. And that's really how we got started. And one thing led to another. Next thing I knew, I was out in Boston pitching the idea for Wrenchhead to Polaris Venture Partners, which was one of the early venture firms in the internet world. And I think I remember shaking hands with them about 1 o'clock in the morning on funding for this company, and ended up making a decision right then and there to sell the company that I had and move out to New York to start this business, and haven't looked back since.
And were you, and the Wrenchhead and Autotech, I'm guessing a little bit of that was doing work in Detroit just with the auto industry, but, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong there, but I want to go back to that first, your little pitch meeting, trying to get some funding, shaking hands at 1 a.m. Were you in there by yourself?
No, it was my partner and I. My partner was, his name was Gus Conradis, and he was my cousin. And he was in the tech business in New York, and I was kind of like on a parallel course in Detroit. And we grew up like brothers and had always wanted to work together, and this was the kind of the perfect opportunity to do so. But, you know, that kind of gives you an idea. I'm not kidding. It was, there was so much activity at this time that that was about the slot that we could get in. I think we started at 11 o'clock at night and worked our way through the pitch, and they agreed.
That's great. And, okay. What's that?
Oh, I was just going to say, and you're right, the whole, the you know, I was in the automotive business in Detroit, and Wrench Ed was an online parts store, in effect. And so it was kind of, you know, those two factors came together in a really unique way that allowed us to start that business.
And then has your mindset always been, I want to go find the next thing that I'm passionate for and create a business? Or are you, is it more of looking in the marketplace into, I guess, an audience to determine what's a miss or a need and an opening to then see if you can go figure out?
It's, you know, I'll tell you what, it's a little bit of both, right? So they have to have those two attributes. In other words, I've looked at dozens, hundreds of business plans, contemplated them, and discarded, you know, 99% of them because they were either maybe the idea was a feature, not a product, or was maybe a really interesting product but serving too small of a market, or solving a problem that people really didn't perceive that they had, you know. And so at the end of the day, you've really got to look at these things through a consumer's mind, through your own eyes, right? And say, you know what, that's pretty awesome. I would use that, and that solves a problem that I have. And that's really, to me, at the end of the day, the key. So there's and that's a hard thing to do, is to find, you know, an idea that really truly is what we would call an elegant solve, and does so in a large enough market, and be something that people are willing to pay money for.
Yeah, I think about that every day here, just at Octagon, and on the ventures perspective of looking at products or services that are beneficial for influencers or celebrities, talent, but are they beneficial to the 10 million people that follow that person? There's a fine line to make sure that whatever that product or business is has scale to the consumer.
Yeah, no, that's 100% right.
And then, so then you worked your way to New York, and then have you been in New York ever since? And I know you had another business that you ultimately sold to eBay before we got into the mattress world, which we'll talk about here in a sec.
Yeah, so Wrenchhead actually became WHI. The very, you know, very insightful branding there. WHI obviously stood for Wrenchhead Inc. That was a business that that we had to pivot. You know, that was a word we didn't have then, but we have it now. And we pivoted from being an e-tailer to being a SaaS, you know, software as a service. We basically provided an e-commerce platform for auto parts sellers. And we did that around 2003, and that business really exploded once we did that. And ended up growing that to about a $2 billion a year business when we sold it to eBay. And that's how I ended up in California for about 3 or 4 years working for eBay. I started out running eBay Motors, which was an $8 billion a year business for them, about half of it selling parts, the other half selling used cars. And then had a bunch of success there. And by the time I left, I was running all of the verticals for North America. So that meant fashion, home and garden, motors, daily deals, etc. Really great experience. But I was commuting from New York to California almost on a weekly basis, and that got a little old.
What was it that you saw in the market back in 2003 that made you or gave you the thought that you need to pivot from being an e-tailer to a software business or a software service business?
Well, it was actually pretty simple. I just did the math. And realized that we were essentially shipping out a $5 bill in every box that we sent out the door. And that's a tough way to make money. But we had considerable interest within the industry from other part sellers that kept saying, hey, would you build a wrenchhead.com for my business? And that was sort of like, that was sort of the epiphany. So we began saying yes to that. And it became so successful that we, within a 9-month period of time, that we made the decision that, hey, you know what? This is like a 95% gross margin product that we can sell versus a 12% gross margin. This is a better business. Let's do this instead. So we ended up selling the dot-com business to Napa Auto Parts, and focusing solely on this business of providing e-commerce solutions to sellers.
Interesting.
That was just a real learning. You know, unit economics are everything.
Yeah, fascinating. And then you jump, and then you get back home, or at least come back to the East, to New York. And did you already have the role at Tomorrow Sleep, or from Serta, or did you find that once you came to market?
No, it came to market. You know, so spent some time after that, spent several months just looking and talking with a lot of people, trying to decide what would be fun and interesting to do next. And that's when I ran into the private equity owner of Serta Simmons Bedding, which is the largest bedding manufacturer in North America. And they had a big problem to solve. Traditional retail, where they sold 99% of their mattresses, was declining, right? So that's Macy's, Sears, all those types of companies. And on the other hand, you had this direct-to-consumer market that was just exploding. And looked at it and said, hey, you know, with the resources of Serta Simmons and a strong e-commerce team, you know, a team of digital marketers and developers, I think that we could launch a new business, what we'll call Tomorrow Sleep, and become a direct-to-consumer seller of mattresses. And that's, and as well as other bedding products, too. We sell what we call a complete sleep system to help people get the best sleep they can. And so we launched that in July of last year, and have been just on a wild ride since then.
And is the marketplace, I guess stagnant's not the, that's the wrong word, but has the transition already taken place of how one buys a mattress, or is there a next to that also?
Well, we're in what I call it, we're in the hockey stick phase of adoption right now. And I've seen this, you know, an industry or a vertical kind of runs along and it's kind of got this low growth path online. And then all of a sudden there's an inflection point and it just like leaps up. And that's exactly what's happening right now. So maybe last year, 10, 8, 9% of mattress sales were online. That number is growing at about 50% per year now and accelerating. And we'll probably run all the way through, I don't know, 25%, 30%+ by the time it starts leveling off again sometime over the next several years.
And is that a function of the next buyer of a mattress? It continues to get younger, or a first mat, and they've already adopted into the way they buy? Or is that adoption actually somebody that may even be 50 that's bought 5 or 6 or, I don't know, 20 or 30, and they now feel comfortable to buy because they know what they like?
It's almost the latter. You know, if you look at so many of these internet products, right? Facebook is a great example of that, right? Like, who started using Facebook? Young people, right? And then next thing you know, the moms were on there, and the dads, et cetera, and it begins to snowball. So I think in this case, yeah, this is the early adopters of buying a mattress in a box, shipped straight to your door without having to go into a showroom. You know, really were younger folks who don't go into stores by and large to begin with, but is now rapidly accelerating and including is expanding across multiple demographics.
So we're going to circle back to when you're at Miami in a few weeks. When you're sitting across from these guys, what young men and women, what's the lesson you tell them after the presentation's done of what life's going to be like when they walk out of campus 2 weeks later, or what they should look for next, or some critical things to learn or some skills to gain right away?
I think, to me, it always starts with the consumer. So, you know, as we kind of talked about earlier, whatever product or service that you're developing, you have to have a clear understanding that this is a product that consumers are going to want and they're willing to pay money for. And, you know, the best way to do that is to get out there and start testing. And that's another big lesson I've learned over the past several years is it's anything that's talked about in a boardroom is an idea, and it's no more than that. You don't get into business until you start getting into business and asking people to start spending money for something you're trying to sell.
That's interesting. And now, fortunately for everybody, testing is easier because of the world we live in and the internet and digital and social. We can get that information back a lot quicker than once used to run some 30-second spots in Kansas City and come back in a couple of weeks and see how they tested.
It's incredible. I love it. It's the amount of data, the ease of testing, and the data that you can get back in almost near real time is just incredible. It's made life so much easier in so many ways. It used to be when I first started, you know, it would be a gut check. You know what I mean? You would have to kind of, you know, wet your finger, stick it up in the air, and say, "I think this is going to happen." Now it's almost never that way. You can test almost anything. At the end of the day, it still comes down to a decision, because data is never perfect. But at least you've got, you know, you can get some data back and get a pretty good idea of whether or not what your hypothesis is going to be directionally accurate.
So when you go to Oxford here in a couple of weeks, what's the one place you're going to visit it from a building or a location, and what's going to be the first food you put in your mouth?
I was just going to say that the first building I will probably visit is Skipper's.
Yeah.
I will probably get, either a gyro or cheese fries. I haven't decided. Maybe both.
I told Andy when I close the pod every time, I always say, "See at Skipper's," and I sent a note to Andy to let him know, and he said, "That's great. Beers are still $2.50 for you."
Well, being in New York, that's a heck of a deal.
Thank you, Brian, for taking time this week on Beyond High Street. An enjoyable conversation for sure. Really liked his comments about pivoting and learning, something that we all do every single day, not just in the workplace, but also at home, pivoting. Check him out again, students, professors, alumni, anybody on campus May 10 when he's back at the Farmer School. Great person, great personality. If you get a few minutes, stop in and say hello. He's always got a tip for everybody. Thanks again for listening. We will catch up soon. See you at Skipper's.